Welcome to Roll Call, a 126th Air Refueling Wing podcast of the Illinois Air National Guard at Scott Air Force Base. I'm your host, Senior Master Sergeant Brian Ellison. The Roll Call podcast focused on people, mission, and community. Happy holidays coming up. Mr. Phil Stratton, Wing Budget Analyst. He talks about his time as host of Roll Call, his career in the military, and he shares his job as budget analyst. Isn't just about telling us, no, we can't spend money. And at the end of the podcast, I'll have a return of our holiday tradition and play a Soldier's Silent Night. Speaking of the budget and personal finances and whatnot, a personal financial counselor is available this Saturday of drill at Military and Family Readiness. You do need to make an appointment. You can find that link in the description of this podcast. The Holiday Bazaar is back. It's great for stocking stuffers. It's in a new location at Building 5000. It's open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday of drill from 12:30 to 3:30. The Force Development Office is hosting a Community College of the Air Force CCAF briefing this Sunday morning of drill at 08 in Building 5000 in the Mission Support Group conference room. The briefing will cover what the CCAF is and why it matters to enlisted members, how to enroll, and degree completion requirements, opportunities for pursuing a secondary degree after cross-training, additional benefits and resources available through the program, professional military education credits, so much more. You'll find that out this Sunday of drill at the Community College of the Air Force briefing at 08, Building 5000 in the MSG conference room. The Cardinal Creek Gate will be closed Saturday afternoon for outbound traffic. Don't worry, though. It'll be reopened Sunday for normal operations. Holiday meal kits are available for E6 and below with dependents there provided by the Wounded Warrior Project Sunday. This Sunday afternoon from 2 to 3:30 in Building 5000. Check with leadership if you're not already registered. Now, I know what you're saying to yourself. You're saying to yourself, how am I able to share all this wealth of information? Where did I get it from? Well, my friend, I got it from Wingtips, and it's sent to your military email. It's probably there right now. Go check it out. It's got all this information and a whole lot more. That's Wingtips. Check your military email for that. Joining us today is the original host of Roll Call in a different form, the former commander of the Logistics Readiness Squadron and now a civilian. He is a budget analyst with the Comptroller Flight, retired major, Mr. Phil Stratton. Thank you for joining us today, sir. What form was the Roll Call? What form was Roll Call when you did it?
Sure, yeah. Well, first of all, it's kind of surreal being back in this studio after all of these years actually recording a Roll Call in a different format. So, yeah, Roll Call back then was basically a short-form video. Basically, it mimicked a newscast.
Okay.
So this was in 2002 is mainly when we did it. Way before podcasting was around. So I think the RSS feed and podcast came around 2003, 2004. So Right. We were just doing a little video newscast that was aired over the closed circuit TV, CCTV here.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So what happened was the wing commander at the time, Brigadier General Kiesler, identified a problem that he wanted solved, which was how do I get information disseminated to everybody in a consistent format. So he had requested that we put together the Roll Call newscast. So everyone would come in on Saturday morning, get their coffee, say hi, get into their unit Roll Call rooms and whatnot, turn the TV on, and then at about 7:05, the roll call would just air. So everyone got the same newscast at the same time, and then afterwards, it was probably 3 or 4 minute long, and then afterwards, the commanders would then just roll into their normal roll call.
Wow, what rank were you then?
I was a master sergeant.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow, okay. So do you have civilian background experience in broadcasting?
I do. So after high school, I didn't join the military right after high school.
Oh, okay.
I went to Columbia School of Broadcasting, downtown Chicago. Thought I wanted to be a radio broadcaster.
Sure.
And after completing the program there, I decided to join the Air Force, and I thought I could get some experience at a radio station while getting more education, all that kind of stuff, and I thought the Air Force would be a great way to do that. So I was stationed at Grissom Air Force Base in Central Indiana, and as a finance troop. So I was working finance, and then on weekends I was hired through WWKI Radio in Kokomo, Indiana. So I did weekend programming at a local radio station there.
What kind of music did? Was it music?
It was country. Yeah.
Oh boy.
Not a big country fan.
Nope.
But you work a lot. You're pulling carts and doing all that kind of stuff for the next person to come in, so you're working a lot. And early 90s, Dwight Yoakam, Hal Ketchum, some of those big names, Garth Brooks, they were all coming out at that time. So I have to admit, I gained a bit of an appreciation for them.
Yeah, and I worked in country a little bit, and really, at the end of the day, you're hardly listening to the music.
Exactly.
So it's just, you give the people what they want, and you give facts and whatnot about their favorite artists, and you move on. You get a job where you get a job if you want to be in broadcasting. So
right,
but I'm sure like me, you found that there's no money in radio.
Exactly. Yeah,
and there's no job security.
Correct.
I thought I would get into radio back here in St. Louis when we moved back from Wyoming. Mm-hmm. And then I'm reminded every once in a while when I see firings at radio stations, I'm like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of years paying your dues and building up bigger and bigger markets, that kind of stuff. That's when you actually start making some money, is in those bigger markets. But a lot of years of paying your dues and stuff. So it didn't end up being the career path that I pursued. No regrets there, but it was a great experience.
So you weren't in PA when you did roll call?
I was not. I was in finance. Roll call was very much a joint effort throughout the wing. So I was, like I said, I was in finance at the time. And the folks that ran the board and the cameras and whatnot, audio visuals, what we called it at the time, those jobs were part of Comflight back then. Not PA.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So PA would write the script. Laura Fogarty was the PA officer at the time. I think she was in it for a while and then moved on to a different job, and Mae Alexander came in. But they would write the scripts, and then Comflight, audio-visual would take care of all the production stuff, and then I would just come in and read the script and do the recording. Very much a joint effort throughout the wing to get that done.
So you were in the active Air Force for 4 years?
I did 2.5 years there.
Oh.
And at the time, back then, guard units were hosted by an active duty base for certain functions, supply and personnel and finance. And the 126 was hosted by Chanute Air Force Base in Rantoul, Illinois, until it closed due to the BRAC in early 90s. So in early 1992, the 126 rehomed from Chanute to Grissom, and that introduced me to people here in the 126, particularly Rick Nyalka, who was the comptroller at the time, later went on to be our group mission support group commander here.
Yeah.
And through that connection, I learned of a vacancy here in the 126 in the finance office. So I palace chased off of active duty into the guard in 1992 up in Chicago.
Were you active guard then?
I was. Yeah, my entire career I was an AGR.
Oh, wow. That is such a cool gig.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So you're from Chicago?
Northwest Indiana, Chicago area, Metro East,
you call it. Yeah. Oh, okay. I got you. All right. So when did you become an officer?
I was selected to be commissioned into the budget officer position in late 2002.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I think our last roll call that we did was December of 2002, and after that I left for the Academy of Military Science, AMS, which is our commissioning program back then, and received my commission through the AMS early 2003.
How long did you spend as a budget officer?
7 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And then you moved over to LRS?
I did. November of 2009, I moved over to LRS as the operations officer.
Okay.
General Jacobs.
Yeah.
Was our LRS commander at the time.
Okay.
So I went over to be his operations officer. He was our commander militarily full-time. He was our environmental officer through CE. So I came in as the operations officer, but full-time I was the full-time logistics manager.
Oh, okay. Wow. How has being the LRS commander... So when did you become LRS commander?
I was operations officer for about 2 years. After that, Colonel Jacobs, General Jacobs now, moved up to the group level,
mm-hmm.
and then I assumed command from him, and then spent 4 years in the seat as the LRS commander until November of 2015 when I retired.
Mm. Oh, you know what I forgot to get? I have a picture of you as a captain. I found a picture of you as a captain. Yeah. Yeah. So how has being the LRS commander, I guess you were a budget analyst before, and how has it informed your job now as a budget analyst?
Sure, yeah. Of course, being the budget officer for several years has been a great help in terms of the technical aspect of the job. But being in command, particularly in the wing here, has informed it quite a bit. You know, everyone's command experience is different.
Right.
We all experience different challenges, different issues that we deal with and whatnot. But having time in that role and understanding the types of challenges and the types of issues that commanders deal with has been a great help in terms of how I can now, in this role, assist commanders in their decisions. And that's what finance really is all about, is that decision support, right? We're managing resources for the wing, but ultimately it's commanders that determine how those resources are going to get expended, be that purchasing items, be that offering training days and resources and different things that to accomplish the mission and to accomplish the training aspects that need to occur.
So as budget analyst, what do you do on a daily basis? I picture you just saying, no, you can't spend money on that.
That's the prevailing attitude, sure. A lot of it is just tracking, managing the resources, doing analysis to help commanders understand where their resources currently sit, so that way they make better decisions. That could be approving orders, approving purchases, yeah. disapproving purchases, and whatnot, sure. But it really changes throughout the year. So finance, particularly in budget, functions a lot like a project. So anyone familiar with project management understands through the PMBOK, the personal or project management book of knowledge, the phases that a project goes through. There's initiating, planning, executing, monitoring, controlling, and then closeout. And we go through all of those phases throughout the fiscal year in a budget cycle. So depending on where we are in that budget cycle will depend on a lot in what we're doing. So in the initiation phase, there's just a lot of getting systems ready for the next fiscal year and that kind of stuff. As we move into planning, we're working with units, we're working with resource advisors and commanders to determine what their requirements for the next year will be in order to develop an execution plan for the wing. As we get into the execution phase, then that's really what most people think of in terms of we are approving or disapproving or working through documents and that kind of stuff. The monitoring and controlling is communicating back, you know, all that to make sure that everyone understands where we're at in the fiscal year, where you're at in your spending. And then closeout is that end of year period where we're trying to get every last dollar spent and obligated. Yeah. We're trying to make sure all of our books are aligned properly, those kinds of things. So it very much depends. I had created what I call the fiscal year calendar, or fiscal year clock, actually. So, you know, on a clock face, there's 12 numbers. Well, there's 12 months. So as you go through the fiscal year, then if you look at the clock, where the hand is will kind of dictate where we're at in the fiscal year and the type of activities, because not every phase happens within, you know, the first quarter, second quarter, mm-hmm. third quarter. You're doing a lot of things for the next fiscal year in the third quarter or the fourth quarter of the year before. So it kind of helps get a visualization as to the types of activities that we're doing throughout the year.
So are there major categories that you see come up a lot, or is it just many categories that you're dealing with in budget?
Well, we have standard categories in terms of the type of money that we have.
Right.
So we have two major annual appropriations that we deal with. The first one is called military personnel funding, or MIL-PERS money.
Okay.
And the other one is operations and maintenance, or O&M money. And these are appropriations that are passed by Congress that have very specific usage rules about them. So on the MIL-PERS side, commanders primarily are responsible for the training and equipping of their people. And the MIL-PERS money is there to allow that, mm-hmm. to get that done. So we're thinking of annual training and special training and those types of activities where we're formal school training, the clothing for our uniforms and that kind of stuff. So all of that is MIL-PERS money. On the O&M side, it's for the operations and maintenance of the facilities, of the base, of the flying mission. Mm. So we're talking about categories like civilian pay and the flying hour program and different things like that. So a lot of what we're doing day to day is not only what I mentioned before, but it's keeping people in the right lane in terms of which of those funds that they're trying to execute, making sure that one doesn't dip into the other because they have to stay separate.
Huh. It seems like they would be clear demarcations, but I guess not.
Sometimes more than others. Sometimes we want for something to really be in one area when it goes in the other. So we try to find a way to put it into one category. So a lot of what we're doing is advising, right, to make sure that we're making good decisions and that we're utilizing the funds in the way that Congress meant for them to be used.
So the KC-135 flying hour program is a huge part of the wing operations. How do you forecast and manage that cost?
Well, fortunately, these days, we don't have to do much of that. It used to be in the past, we did a lot of that here locally. But currently, at the National Guard Bureau level, they do a lot of tracking to the point where they can do a lot of that forecasting themselves. Mm. And basically what they're doing is they're tracking all of the costs that go into flying the aircraft, fuel costs, supply costs for parts and repairs and all of that kind of stuff. So they're tracking all of that, and they're determining how much does it cost for a KC-135 to fly every hour. And I don't know what the current cost is. Let's roughly say it's $4,000 an hour.
Okay.
And so they're tracking that, working with the operations group to determine how many hours we're going to fly this year. So let's, again, big round numbers, let's say it's 2,000.
Right.
Right. So $4,000 an hour times 2,000 hours, right? So they're funding it based off of that. And then they're tracking it to make sure, are we executing it at around $4,000 an hour? Has something happened where our cost is jumping up near $4,500 an hour? Or are we being more efficient and we're coming in under that cost per flying hour?
Oh, and that's where the MEEP comes in.
Correct, right. The more that we can find ways to be more efficient, the more cost savings we can generate, the more we can potentially reap some of the benefits of that and improve the financial situation of our wing by recouping some of those cost savings and using them for other parts of our mission.
Yeah, that's cool. And we did it again. We won the MEEP or whatever. We're hoping to get money awarded for the MEEP this year again.
Correct.
That's cool. What's something airmen would be surprised to learn that we spend money on?
Well, I hope there's not a lot that they would be surprised by.
Yeah, I would think not.
I think there's a lot that they're surprised that we don't spend money on.
Oh, okay.
Right? So, again, when we talk about categories, we've come up with some local categories when we're doing that execution plan phase. We want to help the commanders prioritize the money that we have so that way it's most effectively impacting the mission. So we've come up with categories such as, is this a safety issue that you're looking to apply money towards? Is this a mission generation requirement? Is this just a general operations? Is this a modernization where you can get the job done, but if we had better equipment, we could be more efficient? Or is this what we call quality of life? Mm-hmm. And that's the one that kind of draws some confusion. When they think quality of life, they think, wow, something that I would really enjoy, like maybe my own ice cream machine just sitting right next to my desk type thing.
Right.
But when we say quality of life, it still has to be within the appropriated funds category. So Congress, again, is very specific about what we can spend appropriated funds on. So when we do quality of life, we have to still play by those rules. It's difficult sometimes because people look across the base and they might see some things that others have, you know, and wonder, hey, can we have something similar to that?
Right.
But active duty has different kinds of money that we don't get, such as MWR money, morale, welfare, and recreation. The Guard doesn't get that. So they're able to buy some things that we can't buy because of the type of money that they receive. Also, they get something called NAF, non-appropriated funds, and those are different rules. So we just kind of have to stay within the rules that we have. Then the final thing is there might be some things that we bought here within the 126th many years ago, right? We've been down here for 26 years now.
Yeah.
And we have some equipment and different things that are starting to show their age. Well, when we moved down here, we were provided funds. The city of Chicago paid for this move, and we had a lot of money that was non-appropriated funds. The city of Chicago wrote a check, so we were able to buy some things because it wasn't appropriated money that we might not be able to necessarily replace with appropriated money. So we just have to make sure that we're following those rules.
So does the 906th help, having the 906th, our active duty association, do they help, going back to the flying hours, do they help with that? I mean, having them, because they helped us during the shutdown. I mean, we were able to fly because of the 906 during the shutdown, right?
Correct, yeah. Yeah, they play a very important role in us being able to perform and execute our mission. Having that partnership is very helpful in terms of making sure that those flying hours and they're calculated into the number of hours that we can fly, but having that flexibility during the shutdown and different things like that absolutely plays an important role to make sure that the mission that we have is executed.
Do you handle the budget for the 906th?
We don't. No, they report through the 375th.
Oh yeah,
and they get funding and. Through them to perform their part of the mission.
Ah. So speaking of the shutdown, how did it affect your job as budget analyst? Did you have anything to analyze?
Well, initially I was furloughed.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So because my role wasn't necessarily considered an accepted position, I was initially furloughed. Until the wing commander and the TAG had determined that the combat readiness exercise that occurred at the end of October was to be an accepted activity. So once that occurred, then it was decided to bring me back in because I manage all of those days and dollars and whatnot that everyone was going to be executing to perform that exercise. So probably 2 weeks into it, I was called back in.
Were you thankful to be called back in?
I enjoy working here, and
I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have been furloughed for that. I mean, I know I wasn't getting paid, but I was still working. But being at home, stuck at home, doing man, that'd have been holy cow.
Yeah, no, I was thankful to come in and contribute and do what I could to make sure that the Cree was successful, and by all accounts, sounds like it was. So
cool. How long have you been in the wing then?
I came off of active duty in 1992, so I was in the wing from 92 until I retired in 2015, so 23 years.
Wow.
And then I retired in 2015, had the fortunate opportunities to work on the civilian sector. Title V positions, we didn't have them when I retired, so I had no...
Oh, really?
I had no expectation or thoughts of coming back into the wing. So I worked in the civilian sector for a while, went to the Federal Reserve Bank and to BJC Healthcare for a little while, came back into the government through Transcom as a team lead in the budget office over in Transcom. But then there was the position here in the 126th Comptroller Flight for a budget analyst. So I jumped on the opportunity to come back and figure out how I could once again help the wing perform this mission that I hold pretty dear. So I've been back for almost 3 years, so including the first part, and now this, 26 years
total
with the wing.
So did you came down from Chicago?
I did, yeah.
What was that experience like?
It was great. We enjoy the area down here. A lot of our family is still up north, and
sure.
A lot of folks had asked when I retired if I was going to be moving. Were we going to be moving back home? But we've made it home here, and we love it. But the move itself was both great and challenging. It's a long way from home for a lot of people.
Sure.
And so being in finance at the time, guard units don't typically PCS.
Sure.
Like we had to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that process of learning how to pay everyone's PCS and the government bills of lading for all of the equipment that we moved down and all that kind of stuff was challenging, but it was a great challenge, and I enjoyed it.
Did you, how did they help? Did they help you guys find housing or something?
No, there was no help there, but we were allowed to do some like permissive TDY.
Oh, okay, good.
Where we come down and do a house hunting trip.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I remember. Yeah, I got that when I was on active duty. You get 10 days permissive TDY to get housing and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Anything else you want to add?
Just that if anyone's interested in learning more about finance, I'm happy to talk to them. Come down and have a conversation. Talk to our comptroller, our flight commander, Captain Heiser, or anybody in the office. We'd love to talk to you about it. Again, there's a lot of great transferable skills in terms of, I mentioned earlier, how we utilize a lot of the principles of project management.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting more and more into data analytics, so learning Power BI and Power Automate and all of those things to come up with tools that help commanders, help units to analyze their own spending and their funding and whatnot has been a lot of fun, a lot of good challenges there. So things like that, it's more than just crunching the numbers and whatnot.
Sure.
There's a lot of great skills that you can learn, and whether it's utilizing them here or taking them out in the civilian world. And as far as that goes, I'd say also don't be afraid to volunteer and say yes, to utilize skills that you have here in the guard and in the wing. My experience with being a broadcaster, I wasn't in PA,
right?
But I was able to utilize those to still benefit the wing. So people that have skills and they like decorating, or they like barbecuing, or they like whatever they like doing, there's ways to help within the wing utilizing those skills. So that would be my only advice and takeaway, is don't be afraid to say yes and help out the wing with any of the skills and interests that you have outside of your AFSC.
Great. That is the budget analyst with the comptroller, retired major, Mr. Phil Stratton. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
If you're watching on YouTube, you can see our new military wall art that we have up here. It's the wing crest. Looks pretty cool on our wall. If you're not watching on YouTube, you should check it out just to see our military wall art. You can find all our links on Linktree, linktr.ee/126ARW. If you are watching on YouTube, that is awesome. Don't forget, you can also download this on your favorite podcast app. Since this is the last podcast of the year and it's the holidays, I wanted to leave you with a Soldier's Silent Night. It started out as Merry Christmas, Friend. It was written with Marine Bent back in the early 80s, I believe around 1983. It was later adopted to A Soldier's Silent Night to apply to everyone in the military. It was then recorded in the early 2000s by Father Ted Burnt, an Episcopal priest. He himself was a Marine, a World War II veteran, and a Purple Heart recipient. Thanks for listening to Roll Call, a 126th Air Refueling Wing podcast focused on people, mission, and community. I'm Senior Master Sergeant Brian Ellison. Have a happy holiday.
It was the night before Christmas. He lived all alone in a one-bedroom house made of plaster and stone. I had come down the chimney with presents to give and to see just who in this dwelling did live. I looked all around, a strange sight to see. No tinsel, no presents, not even a tree. No stockings on the mantle, just boots filled with sand. On the wall hung pictures of far distant lands. Medals and badges, awards of every kind. A sobering thought came alive in my mind. This house was different. It was dark, it was dreary. I had found the home of a soldier. I could see that most clearly. The soldier lay sleeping, silent, alone, curled up on the floor in this one-bedroom home. His face was so gentle, the room in such disorder, not at all how I pictured a United States soldier. Was this the hero of whom I'd just read, curled up on a poncho, the floor for a bed? Then I realized the other families that I saw this night owed their lives to soldiers who were willing to fight. In the morning round the world, children would play. Grown-ups would celebrate a bright Christmas day. But they all enjoy freedom each month of the year because of soldiers like the one lying here. I couldn't help but wonder how many lay alone on a cold Christmas Eve in lands far from home. The very thought put a tear to my eye. I dropped to my knees and I started to cry. The soldier awakened. I heard his rough voice. Santa, don't cry. This life is my choice. I fight for freedom. I don't ask for more. My life is my God, my country, my core. The soldier rolled over and drifted asleep. But I couldn't control it, and I continued to weep. I kept watch for hours, so silent and still, as both of us shivered from the cold night's chill. I didn't want to leave him on that cold, dark night, this guardian of honor, so willing to fight. Then the soldier rolled over with a voice soft and pure. He whispered, "Carry on, Santa. It's Christmas Day, all secure." One look at my watch, I knew he was right. Merry Christmas, my friend. May God bless you this night.